Okay, I'm recording. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Margaret Ann. Several of you have commented on the fact that I do not appear to have any kind of an accent whatsoever. Even after living in the great state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I should say, for just about 30 years. Living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the Boston area, you wonder why I have not picked up the colorful native patois. Just so as I can assure you, I can put it on with the best of yous. And the explanation is that I was raised on Long Island in New York. I was raised in Great Neck. I lived there until I was 12 years old, but I was raised by Midwesterners. My mother was born in Sharpsburg and raised in Clarinda. Oh. So, I have been here several times. I have an uncle who lives in Shambaugh, which I'm sure none of you have ever even heard of, even if you've lived in Iowa all your life. You've heard of Shambaugh? Okay, all right. And when I was 12 years old, we went on a family vacation. I went with my mother's sister, my Aunt Marie. That's one regionalism I picked up. It does no longer sounds correct to me to say my aunt, even though that's what I said all my life. But in Boston, it's your aunt. So she's my Aunt Marie. I don't know. It still sounds right to call her my Aunt Marie. But I'm my niece's aunt. And I went with her and her husband, Boris. Boris was from Omaha. He was from a Serbo-Croatian family, Boris Georgiev. So we took a trip, we visited various friends of theirs. We'd started out, we'd had a family vacation in the Lake of the Ozarks. And so we went through various different towns, I don't remember how many. We spent a couple of days in Clarinda, and they took me out to the family graveyard in Shambaugh. Now, up until this point, I'd been raised in Great Neck, I had no family there. My father and mother had moved out there from Colorado, which is where they'd gotten married. He went to University of Northern Colorado at Greeley, and then he got his master's at Columbia Teachers in New York, and then he got a job teaching at the Merchant Marine Academy in Kings Point, New York, which is how I ended up in Great Neck. So when I was growing up, we didn't have any nuclear family, and I had contact with my cousins, my mother's sister, so I knew Marie and Boris and their two kids. And then when I was 9, I met some cousins and the family, my aunt and uncle who lived in Texas. And eventually, after we moved to Texas, after my father got sick, I met my Uncle Jim, who's in Shambaugh. He'd been in the Merchant Marine until he retired from the Merchant Marine at age 55. And didn't marry until he was almost 60 years old. And so he's 86. He lives in Shambaugh. And I don't really have any contact with him, but I just thought that was pretty amazing that I was going to be in the ancestral area. So when I was 12, they took me out. First off, we came into Clarinda, and they were having this big family reunion picnic, partly because we were there. And here's your great aunt Marie, and here's your great aunt Ines, and your great uncle Harold, and this is your second cousin, Debbie and Floyd and all these people. I had no idea who they were. It was really kind of intimidating because I had no idea I had this much family. I'd had this tiny little family. And then a couple of days later, they took us out to the graveyard in Shambaugh. Well, there's your great-great-grandfather, and there's your great-great, and it was going down the rows expecting to find the headstone that said Margaret Ann Brady, 1959 blank, They were waiting for me, but I never did. So, but those are my roots. Good, solid Midwestern farm people. The kind of people who worked hard out in the fields, who had 3 beige meals a day. Good, solid food that you need for back-breaking labor. And that's the way my mother knew how to cook, pretty much. And though she was very health conscious and modified the way she fed her family, but essentially that's what I was, kind of raised on: farm food, southern food, Midwestern food. She made, great fried chicken and stuff like that. And my body is of Northern European extraction, so as it's been explained to me back thousands of years ago, we hunted and grazed and then farmed all summer, and at the harvest times we ate as much as we could for the long winter months, when eventually the food that we'd put by, that we'd salted or dried or whatever, would run out, and we would live on our stored fat until the spring came again. And that's how we got through the year back in those days. So the people who survived were the people who were really good at storing fat. And so what our bodies find out when we diet, our bodies go, okay, I know how to deal with this. It's the winter, and the food stores are gone. So I'm going to hold on to every calorie I get. I'm going to sparingly use my energy reserves to fuel the body. But as soon as that food comes back, man, I'm going to grab it. And that's what happened to me every single time I dieted. My body went into starvation mode. I would lose a certain amount of weight, and then my body would do what it did. And as soon as I reintroduced the usual amount of food, it would pack it in and pack it on. And no wonder I had this little schism with my body, because I kept thinking what I'm doing is I'm going to slim my body down until it's amazing and fit and wonderful. And then I'm going to exercise, exercise, exercise. And my body would say, okay, you need energy. I'm going to give you just as much as you need. And then as soon as I can get some more stores in, I'm going to store it because you're starving me now. So my body is doing exactly what it's programmed to do. That's what it's primed for. And what in my mind I was doing, because I didn't understand what was happening, I was intending for one result, but I was ensuring another. And so, since the two of us had completely different agendas, it's not at all surprising that we ended up in divorce court, pretty much. And the only entity that could mediate was a spiritual one. And I had absolutely no idea that was going to be the answer to this problem. You know, human bodies are just incredible. I've read a lot about, you know, how we evolved into these, you know, how do we develop speech, and, you know, what's happened to us as a result of our diet changing over hundreds and thousands of years. And when you think about what the human body is really meant to do, the way most of us live today, you know, I put very little physical demand on my body. I drive a lot of places. I sit a lot of the time, so I'm riding from place to place. I don't even have to chew as much as my ancestor did 500 years ago, because so much of my stuff is processed or ground up very efficiently. And I don't have to work as hard at it. So it's really not a surprise when I look at it in that way that these eating disorders are so common, and that we have gained a lot of weight. Not everybody. We all know those people who seem to just make use of every single calorie they get in, and no problem, but that's not me. So, because I was so completely off the mark when it came to what my physical problem is, is it any wonder that I was completely off the mark when it came to understanding what all of my problems were? So the thing that I put up first, if God is the solution, then what's the problem? It's like a koan. You know, in Zen Buddhism, they give you these inscrutable things that you're supposed to just kind of print. They're like Rubik's Cubes for the mind, and eventually maybe they lead to enlightenment or whatever. But that's a good one, because that one always works for me. If God's the solution, then what's the problem? Because I have to ask myself, if my problem is weight, as I noted last night, God is not going to put the food in the cup for me. God is not going to do my grocery shopping for me. God is not going to pack my lunch for me. So then what's the problem if I can't do that? Well, it turns out that my problem isn't simply the packing of the lunch or the not eating of the thing or whatever. the problem is deeper than that. The problem is this self-reliance, this bondage of self. And so how is God the solution to that? Well, the good news, and we don't have the lock on this at all, but the good news is that the 12 steps really do provide a solution for that problem. I can't tell you exactly how, I just know that it's worked. If my problem was that I couldn't live a healthy and happy life, having worked the 12 steps, I can tell you that I now live a happy and healthy life. I've, you know, a lot of ways to go, and such suffering as I have today in my life, I still turn it over to that. So what's the problem, right? Okay, here's a for example. Some of you have heard this story, but forgive me for this. The company that I, one of the companies I do the tour guiding for, said that tomorrow, October 10th, was a mandatory day. There's 3 or 4 ships in Boston that day. Everybody had to work. Well, as soon as they sent out the schedule last spring, I immediately wrote back and said, I'm not available. I did it again in August. I'm not available. 2 weeks ago, I'm not available. But I never got an acknowledgement, so my problem is that now I am afraid. I'm afraid they're mad at me. I'm afraid they won't use me again. So that's my problem. My problem is fear. The situation is what it is. But I'm afraid. What can I do about it? I can't do anything about it. Here I am. I'm not going to be there tomorrow, and I can't change that situation. I'm not willing to change that situation. I had made a commitment to come here. Now, in self-reliance, this is what occurs to me. Okay, so first off, I should have lied. I should have given them a better excuse. Family wedding, something like that. That's the kind of thing that I do out of self-reliance. I come up with what I think is going to work for them. I'm going to manipulate. Okay, what about, and I've already engaged in a little bit of this. What about if I do my old cute puppy routine and say, I'm too cute to be mad at, and go, gee, I hope you're not mad at me. Hope you're not mad at me. You're not mad at me, are you? Which is disgusting. And, you know, sometimes works, but it doesn't make me feel very good about myself. And it's not an honest and upfront way of treating other people, and it's more self-reliance. I can wildly try to, and so this is the other thing that I'm doing. So what I'm afraid of is that they're not going to use me for the rest of the season. And so I'm checking my email compulsively, trying to see if there's a notice about working on Monday. And as soon as I get that email, boy, I'm going to respond and say, I'll be there. I'm loyal. I'm not here yesterday, but I'll be there Monday. I'm good. You know me. I'm right there. And that's, I do enjoy being a really good employee. I really do. I enjoy being reliable, responsive, willing. They throw stuff at me, you know, last second. And I enjoy going out of my comfort zone and doing stuff like that. But I'm continually watching my tendency to then do those kinds of behaviors, to say yes when I mean no. This was a, I don't want to get too far off the topic of where we're going with this, talking about the problem. But I just want to give an illustration of what I mean when I talk about acting out of self-will rather than God's will. I had a terrible character defect of double booking myself. Or even just saying, I'm going to do this, and then implying to somebody else, well, maybe I could do that, and then thinking, well, maybe I can get out of that first one. Or did I really do, you know, so promising to do, to be in two places at the same time, and then getting caught in the squeeze of my own dishonesty. And what's my motivation? I want you to like me. I want you to approve of me. I want you to give me what I want. What's the fear? I'm not going to get what I want. So here's my fear, that I won't get what I want by them approving me and continuing to use me. Well, you know what? That could happen. That's not my problem. That's the situation. My problem is the fear. Fear that I won't get the work, so there's that, you know, bit of material security that's affected. Fear that they won't like me, they'll be mad at me. Fear of their opinion. Oh no, could anybody dislike little Margaret Ann? God, where is God in this? Nowheresville. If I lose my job over this, that is the way the situation is. How is God going to solve that problem? God is going to give me the power to go forth and job hunt. You know, get more work. I got this job, we'll get another one, you know. I'm not in danger of losing my house or anything like that. So what I get to see is that my problem is fear. My problem is a lack of faith. My problem comes in a billion different ways, but if God is the solution, then the problem is spiritual. It says in the big book, where the guy in, I believe, the chapter more about alcoholism, and this really got to me, and I should have marked it before. Yeah, here it is. Bottom of page 42 in the chapter more about alcoholism. This is a guy who is told that he's probably alcoholic and that he's going to die if he doesn't accept the spiritual solution. And he sees that he has this problem, but he figures that now his self-knowledge is going to keep him safe. And then he gets drunk. And then two members of Alcoholics Anonymous come to see him. They outline the spiritual answer and the program of action. He becomes sober. The moment he made up his mind to go through the process, it says at the bottom of page 42, I had the curious feeling that my alcohol condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. So there was a solution to one part of his problem, his drinking. But quite as important, as it goes on to say, was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. So that means that I have to redefine my problems in spiritual terms. Being broke is not a spiritual problem, it's a material problem. It's a situation. The problem is the fear that comes up. Because I don't know about you, but a lot of times if I'm afraid, it will lead me to take an action that is completely the opposite of my best interests. If I'm, for example, if I'm afraid of being broke, you know what I'll do? I won't open my bills. Or I won't pay them on time. I'll just try to pretend it's not there. That's what fear does for me. Or, you know, the examples that I was just telling you, where I lie to my employer, or I start to try to emotionally manipulate them, which is obnoxious, or, you know, all these other things. Those are the things that I will try to do out of fear. Whereas if I'm acting out of faith, then I'm going to do the right action and leave the results up to God. And, you know, it really does seem to work. But it's a complete change in attitude and outlook on what my life is, because I thought I used to know what problems were. So step one requires me to admit that I have a problem without really understanding what my problem is. I come in here, I think I'm here because I can't stop eating and my life is falling apart. I think that my life is falling apart because I'm fat or because I'm too thin or because I can't stop thinking about food. I think that all the problems in my life are just related to my food and my weight. And I'm told, no, it's actually worse than that, but, you know, don't worry about that now. Just admit that you have the problem. Admit that you're powerless. Give up. Surrender. Throw up your hands. Stop fighting. Give up. All right. Next, in step two, I'm asked to make another surrender. I'm asked to act as if there is a God without even believing that there is a God. There's a very telling line at the very end of the chapter We Agnostics in the Big Book. And this should be a relief to anybody who thinks that their success in this program is going to rest on them figuring out what God is or forcing themselves to believe in something. The very last line, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us, goes exactly the opposite the way I thought it should. I thought as soon as I started to believe in God, then I would feel close to God. That's not what this is talking about. This whole chapter is saying that I'm going to act as if there is a power greater than myself. And then I will believe. Then it will be revealed to me. Then it will be proved to me. Just show of hands, has anybody had that happen to them? That they acted as if there was a God, and today that they believe that there is this power? Okay. The rest of you, keep coming. So, I mean, the thing was that I guess I had some concept of a God, but I certainly didn't believe that there was any power that was concerned with what I put on my plate. My eating was not important enough for God, so obviously I had a conception of this power that was insufficient, that was not, yeah, that wasn't working. So in step two, all it's asking me to do is, all right, just act as if this could be true. Move forward. Then, in the third step, I'm asked to decide to move forward into this course of action without having any idea what's going to happen to me. I'm going to let go of my thinking, and I'm going to let go of my actions and all outcomes. That's, you know, big deal, right? Or as I was told when I first came in, you're going to have to change everything but your fingerprints. Now, the paradox of this is that pretty much anybody who knows me and who has known me over the last 20 years believes, and I feel like this myself, believes that I've become more myself than I ever was before. That they really feel like I'm authentically me. That personality, that, you know, that essence of Margaret Ann-ness is very strong, but I think what they're missing is that constant fear, that neediness, you know, that restlessness. Certainly they're not seeing the sarcasm and the criticism and the negativity as much as they were, but it's not like I've become it's not become like I've become that drab cipher that I was really afraid I was going to be. There's nothing wrong with missionaries in Borneo. It just wasn't what I saw myself doing. And that's not how God sees me doing either. Maybe God will. You know, maybe that is what I'll end up doing. I don't know. If you had told me 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago, that I'd be doing what I was doing today, I would have said, really? But, you know, things get revealed. But, I mean, that's the case for anybody. You know, life pretty much goes on as it does. I just feel that I've been lucky that many of the opportunities that I've been presented with, I think, have been directly as a result of doing this step work and being alive to opportunities and not closed in my thinking about what was possible for me. So, after we make this decision, the next thing it says in the big book, after that decision, we closed the last meeting with the third step prayer, talking about offering ourselves to God so that God can build with us and do with us as God will, to be relieved of the bondage of self, to be relieved of our difficulties, not so that we can, you know, live happy, easy lives, but so that our victory over our difficulties will light the path for other people, so that that light will shine through our bodies. What so many people notice about people who change in this program, it's not always a physical change. Not everybody loses weight or gains weight. Many of us do, but what so many people comment on is the light in our eyes, the lightness in ourselves. So in the third step, we are asking for help, but we're also asking for it for the purpose of being able to help others. And then it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. So that's a tall order, because that, like I said, means giving up control over what's going to happen to me. And then it says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. This is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, page 63 into 64. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effect to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor, our eating, was but a symptom. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. Notice the energy of that paragraph. Launched out. Vigorous action. House cleaning. Vital. Crucial. Permanent. At once. Strenuous. Effort. Blocking. Get down. So we're told that it's going to be self, and I already talked about what I found to be true, which is that I can't make the decision to get rid of self and then get rid of self with self. Doesn't work because I'm working with self. Now, I mean, I talk about self as if it's some sort of dirty word. I mean, here it is. We have it. It's here. The mind is a marvelous tool for what it's good for. For what it's good for, it's fantastic. For what it's not so good for, in my case, reading other people's minds and predicting the future, which I keep trying to use it for, that's not what it's made for. The future belongs to everybody. The future belongs to the cosmos. The past also. There's absolutely nothing that I can do to redirect it. And so, well, one of the images that I came up for my mind, and, you know, back to the kind of the tool thing, is that I just have always used it for things it's not appropriate for. And it is a great, for example, you have a hammer, really nice, well-balanced hammer, nice and heavy, fits in your hand, great. Great for what it's good for. Say that I, and you know, maybe I use it for sculpting or something like that in some way, and I have this beautiful work of art, let us call, that's my life, all right? And with my hammer, I have just, you know, knocked off this big chip. And I look at the damage that I've done using the tool. And I go, wow, how am I going to fix this? Oh, look. I have a hammer. Bam, 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 bam. So if I try to use my mind to fix my mind, I'm going to get more of the same stuff. Again, my solutions are simply problems for the future. If I try to be less selfish, what's going to happen is you're going to find me making up my mind what the selfishness is, and then still coming up with a bunch of ideas about what it is that you should be doing, what's going to make you happy, or like worse, the whole world, the whole office, the whole school, you know, whatever group I'm in. I'm going to be making decisions based on my thinking about what's right for everything, what's the perfect outcome. And we've already seen for many of us what the outcome of that attempt to be selfless is. It is harming ourselves thinking that we're being helpful to others and actually helping nobody. You know, if you're putting the oxygen mask on your kids' faces while you are suffocating, and then they end up with a dead mommy. Same thing if I decide that that I know what the solution to my self problem is going to be. So, good news though, fortunately, someone's already kind of worked through this and they have a program of action that's going to work just fine for me as long as I don't try to make it up. So, this is the 12-step solution. So, the third step is followed by a course of vigorous action, and steps 4 through 9 are going to tunnel through everything that blocks me from the sunlight of the Spirit. They are going to build a pathway to this power. The first thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to look very closely at my will in my life, my thinking and my actions, by taking that personal inventory. Those are fun, right? Yeah. So there's a wonderful illustration of the force of the mind and the force of thinking and that belief that our view of things is the way things really are. And the illustration that I've heard is comes from, I don't know, Asia, Africa, I don't know where this starts from. I've heard several different people use it, but there's a kind of a monkey trap that you can only use with monkeys of, you know, animals like that, because animals with lesser capacity for intelligence won't fall for it. You have to be as smart as us, primates, to fall for it. You hollow out a gourd, and you drill a hole in the side just big enough for the monkey's hand to go in, like that. And you put some treats inside. And the monkey reaches in, grabs at a handful of treats, but then the monkey's fist is too big to get out of the gourd. The monkey is trapped by its mind because it doesn't want to let go. If it let go, it would be free. And that's how we are with self. I know who I am. I know who you are. I know what my story is. I know what my future holds. I'm stuck in the trap. I'm holding on to those ideas for dear life. And what I'm being told by this program is, you can get free of the trap if you are willing to open your hand, let all that stuff slip out, and slip free. But the force of those ideas is unbelievable. About the only thing that can motivate people to undergo what we undergo to bring about the psychic change necessary to access this power is unbelievable pain. And we have it. Are you glad? Yay! Yay, torment and suffering. But the good news is that once you get here, if you're lucky enough to start finding the solution, and if you start having some relief from the eating and the other physical difficulties, if you're lucky, you will then maybe also be motivated by the inspiration of wanting that, of being willing to keep pursuing it. Food's down, the weight's whatever, becoming healthy in whatever way that is, and I'm feeling better, but now I want what you have, and I'm also willing to believe, based on what I've heard, that if I don't pursue the solution, eventually I am going to turn back to the food. You know, because the relief, the physical relief is only going to last me so long. The mental relief is only going to last me so long. Eventually something is going to bring me back to the food unless I enlarge my spiritual life. I had a big physical life and a big mental life. My solution to my physical problems, I figured it out in my brain and I applied it in the physical world. You know, I acted, I spoke, I bought, whatever. So the idea here is that I must make my spiritual muscles as strong, stronger than my physical and mental ones in order to have this solution. And if I'm really lucky, once the pain has subsided a little bit, I will continue to be motivated to pursue this course of action. And I've had both, you know, carrots and sticks over my years, I would say. So every part of this is about changing image. And the body image is going to change along with every other part of the image. So the inventory is going to be, it's going to be in three different parts if you do it according to the big book, or you can use the OA workbook, whatever, but it's going to look at basically how did the past not go the way we wanted it to? That's resentment. And how is the future not going the way we want it to? That's fear. And that pretty much covers everything, you know. For most of us, we're living in either one place. Like they say, I got one foot in the past, one foot in the future, and I'm pissing all over the present. Right? So, really, nobody wants to do that inventory. Nobody wants to go back over that past. It was no fun. It was awful. We had horrible experiences, horrible relationships, abuse. Why are you going to make me dredge this all up again? Well, guess, you know, this is not intended to make you feel bad about yourself. You already do. You know? If you're a compulsive overeater, you already have an unhealthy self-image. You have an unhealthy body image. You have an unhealthy mental image. You have an unhealthy spiritual image. You don't have that power. So what the heck? Clean out the basement. Get rid of it. Why keep it around? So, what was the next? The resentments. So the resentments are going to turn up essentially everything that we've already lived through. And one thing that's definitely going to reveal is that it was difficult. It was really, really difficult. And while we're doing it, chances are when we come into this program, we are in difficulty. We have jobs that are very taxing. We have a family that needs our attention. We may have physical ailments that make it really difficult to get to meetings, get to the store, get out when the weather is bad, whatever it is. And yet, what I was told was that whatever the circumstances of my life were, they were the perfect ones for working this program in. That they were going to hold up a mirror to me that was going to show me exactly the way to freedom. And it turns out that my difficulty is my path. I wouldn't be motivated to do this otherwise. Who would go through all this? I heard a wonderful speaker once saying, it was in a discussion, and the person said, how is it really possible to have faith in the face of all these difficulties, all these obstacles? And the speaker said, that's like saying, how is it possible to get from the first to the second floor despite the stairs? What they meant was, that is how you get there. That is the path. That's where we work in it. There's nothing difficult about being in an OA meeting. All right, well, sometimes there is. They're boring, they're too long, you know, whatever. But that's why I'm saying we don't get well in the meetings. We get well in our lives, in our difficulty, in the challenges of being in relationship. Because that's where we're going to practice all of this stuff. This is where we're going to do the letting go. This is where we're going to do the asking for help. This is where we're going to change the way we relate and behave so that God can remove these defects of character. So, next, resentment. What was I going to say about that? I'm working my way into the next little bit of writing, which I hope you will find is rewarding. This isn't necessarily about body, but in looking at my resentments as the first part of my inventory, and the last time I did an inventory, that's exactly what I did. I looked at all the things in my life that hadn't or weren't going the way I wanted them to. That meant people that I had grudges against for whatever it was. It meant principles such as, gravity. You know, it when I let go of something, it falls and it breaks. That bothers me. It's causing my chins to sag, you know, things like that. I was resentful against the concept of you know, the idea you can do anything if you set your mind to it, because I found that to be really difficult, really hard to live up to, things like that. And institutions. I was furious with the utility companies and the government and the church and the temple and, you know, you name it. Everything was not doing things my way. And so I got to see through looking at, what was it that I wanted to happen instead of what did happen? What was my head telling me about this? What did I do to manage it? What was I afraid was going to happen as the result of this? I got to see again and again and again and again exactly where myself, my thinking, my will was off. I got to see it again and again and again. For example, so many people I thought treated me the way they treated me because I was fat or because they liked so-and-so better. I thought I knew why they did what they did. I thought I knew what they were thinking. And I was asked again and again, can you prove that? Do you really know for a fact that you knew what this person was thinking or why they did what they did? And I had to see again and again and again and again, no, I did not. I don't know. And today, I apply that constantly when I, for example, in this situation, I have no idea what Norman and Leslie are thinking. Those are the people that I work for in the tour company. I have no idea. Not a clue. So every time it pops into my head, that little fear and that little, I have to go, you don't know. God, remove this fear and direct my thought to what you would have me be. So the resentments were able to show me a lot of the manifestation of that will, a lot of the ways that my brain reacted to the facts of my life and started filling in the gaps and things like that. I heard another great quote. Speaker said, you know, my story comes in two parts. What happened to me while I was using and what I thought happened to me while I was using. And that's my story. That was what my inventory revealed. The story of my life. I told you already, poor little orphan Margaret. And I dressed it up. There were certain parts of it that I polished and I told, and it all really ended up with me not getting what I deserved. All these things that shouldn't have happened to me. And what was revealed was, oh, wait a minute. Who told me that I'm the one who determines what should happen or what I deserved? So what I was able to see was I was just one moving part. Now, in recovery, this is the great thing. We really do have a lot of influence over our lives. And we can influence other people's lives very positively. We've seen that in our workplaces when we do start telling the truth instead of lying about when I'm, lying about taking a sick day. And if that's the sort of thing you've ever done, once I stopped doing that, I started feeling a lot more peace and ease, and I didn't have to keep track of my lies anymore. And my work environment started really getting different and better. Where was I going with that? Okay, so the resentments, yes, revealing my thinking, and it starts to really be able to change that. The fear inventory also revealed all the different ways in which I had tried to manage my fears. Any fear that had to do with other people's opinions. I did those same old things, manipulating. If it was a fear that you would think that I didn't know something, I would try to be the know-it-all. If I was afraid that I would be seen to not know how to do something, I wouldn't try it. That's sad. So I got to see that, again, my self-reliance on my own thinking had failed me when it came to these situations that I was scared of. And so when I saw this stuff, and then, of course, there was my sex conduct, and these were some really messed up relationships, especially, considering that many of them existed only in my head. So I really got to see that I had spent my whole life thinking that I knew the way things were, thinking that I was seeing things accurately and finding out that I wasn't. That blocked me from the sunlight of the Spirit. And it affected the way I saw myself in relation to the rest of the world. There at the center of the Margo-centric universe. And of course, if I was distorted in my thinking about my whole self, you can bet that my body image was extremely distorted. And because of that, I was blocked from access to the power, and the power could not then, shine out through me. I got to see again and again and again how I had tried to determine outcomes. And that idea in step three, that the rest of my life is none of my business, was absolutely terrifying. God wants it all. God wants my 100% complete and total trust, reliance, and my daily surrender to a source of help. God wants to give me what I need for one day. And when I start demanding that God supply what I think I need for a week, for a month, next year, I will suffer. I will suffer, because that is not living in right relation with the spiritual power. So, you know, somebody shared earlier this idea of the obsession with self, of the obsession with my body, how my body is. It just robs me of so much. It takes me out of relationship with other people. My efforts to control were so ineffectual. My efforts to stop my fears were so ineffectual. So today, there's a lot of outcomes in my life that I'm very concerned about. I am already really concerned about taking care of my in-laws. They're both still, well, actually my father-in-law is retired. My mother-in-law is still working. She just turned 80. He's 78. No, he's 79 years old. They're both totally hale and hearty, living on their own. But I really, really spend time worrying about that. That's an outcome that I am holding on to. So there's lots of those things. What's going to happen to me when I get older? What if I develop dementia? And I don't like Sudoku. I really don't. I don't have children, but I can't imagine an outcome that you wouldn't be more involved in, because they're your children. But how much success have you really had in directing their mind? So again, you know, I can have influence, but how have you been able to change the portfolio price of your mutual fund? Has anybody had any luck at all not aging? Has that you can have surgery and stuff like that. So the next writing I would like to invite us to do, and then after that we'll take a little break. I can see that there's some naps going on out here, so just go ahead. Fall right over. I won't be bothered. So the next question is, what outcomes do I fear letting go of? So we're coming up on Halloween, so this should be nice and scary.
Normally, I'm afraid of letting go.
Yeah. Okay, so it is now 2:25, and we are going to take a break until let's say 10 of. So that's almost. So that gives you about, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes maybe to write, and then a 10-minute break. Get up, walk around, get some fluid, stay hydrated.
Repeat the time one more time.
So it is now, it's like 2:25, we're going to come back at 10 of. So, yeah. Okay. So my pacemaker's plugged in again. So I have some very good news for you all. I certainly don't have another hours left of talking. We have one more bit of writing to do, but I think that we're going to end at 3:30 and then have the entertainment then. And then have a little more time for enjoying the beautiful sunshine. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yay!
Because I'm already sick of hearing myself. Okay, so So when I last did my fourth step, and I've done several fourth steps, I use the OA 12 and 12, I use the workbook, I also go to HOW meetings in my area, and I use the HOW guide, and if you want to know about that, I'll tell you later, but I don't want to go into it now. But as I said, the last time that I went through the 12 steps, I did it guided through the big book by a sponsor who had also been guided through the big book by someone who had been through the big book. So there was a lot of experience with people who are doing it in a very, very definite and structured way, following the instructions that were found in the book pretty closely. And I found the results that I got from that inventory and from everything else were more profound than any results that I'd gotten in any of my other swings through the steps. And the thing that drove me to it, which I can't believe I haven't talked about at all, speaking about changing your story with time, I came in Overeaters Anonymous in 1990, got abstinent that at the end of that year, took me about a year to lose 80 pounds, and around then I started dating this guy that I really, really was very interested in, and 5 years after we'd been together, he asked me to marry him. We got married at the end of that year, and that was 1997. No, we got married in 1996, and then a year later, and a little bit over a year later, he left me, and I was completely destroyed because I didn't see it coming. And I'm trying to tell the story without telling the story too much. Without storytelling, in other words. But, the circumstances were that he had started a relationship with our next door neighbor. And this was a complete and total surprise to me. And I was totally destroyed. It really felt like I had been peeled and dipped in napalm every morning when I woke up. It was unbelievably painful, and the great gift in it was that it brought me into the working the 12 steps in a much deeper way than I had done previously, because I was in so much pain. I started going to these meetings, and I heard this woman talk, and I knew that she had the solution that I needed. I knew when this happened that what was going to be necessary was that I was going to have to forgive him, and I knew that I didn't have the spiritual wherewithal to do that. At that point in 1997, after being abstinent and sober for a while, I knew that I did not have the tools in my spiritual toolkit that were going to get me to that point, that I was going to be able to forgive him and go on and accept this fact of my life. That was the situation. And part of my problem was my inability to accept it and to move on and to conceive of a time that I could forgive him for this, because I thought he had basically murdered, it wasn't just, he had set the entire fabric of reality astray. That was how bad it was, in my opinion. He transgressed reality. And it took me a very long time, just like the friend that had told me how selfish I was. It took me a very long time to kind of reel that back in to being a little bit more proportional to being a violation of the laws of the universe. So that was the pain that I was in when I got there. So I got to do a lot of work, and I wrote for a long time. When I finally got to starting my fourth step, I wrote about all those resentments, I wrote about all those fears, I wrote about my sex conduct. I sat down with my sponsor over the period of several days, and I read everything that I had written. She said very little, but she gave me the unbelievable loving gift of her presence and her attention. And then she told me to go home, sit quietly for an hour, think about what I'd done, if my work had been solid so far, sit an hour in meditation, go over the first 5 steps, make sure that I had been thorough. And then she said, take steps 6 and 7. The 2 paragraphs in the big book, not much to it. Step 6, to repeat, those of you who are following along, step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5, I admitted to God, to my God, to myself, and to another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. What that was I read all that stuff that I'd seen about the mistakes that my self-centered thinking had led me into, about my beliefs about the way the world was. And in step 6, I became entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character. After having seen what my thinking had led me into again and again and again and again over the years, why would I want to keep any of it? Why would I want to hold on to it? So yeah, I was ready to stop doing that stuff. Then in step 7, humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. Well, that is very tricky if you're a person like me who thinks of everything in terms of, well, then what do I do now? And I believe that's why a lot of us get really hung up on steps 6 and 7, because it seems like there's a bit of a paradox. Obviously, it's going to be me who has to stop gossiping. It's going to have to be me who stops lying and judging and manipulating and fill in the rest of the list. Then in both steps, it's saying that I am preparing to have God remove the defects of character. And so what do I do? A lot of people that I've heard over the years, certainly this tripped me up, and I've worked with people as a sponsor that it's tripped up, is that word entirely. Because I believe many of us interpret that to mean that we have to be at a place that we are absolutely ready to stop doing all these things. And I don't believe that that's necessarily what's being asked of us there. Because remember, we can be willing for something to happen that we don't want to do. So, am I entirely willing to have it removed? Yes. Am I entirely willing to have it all removed today? Maybe not so much. But that's what I'm told in our literature. It says many times that there may be things that I'm not ready to let go of. I may not even see them yet. And that's okay, as long as I'm ready to move forward. And I think that the OA 12 and 12 has some of the most beautiful writing on both steps, 6 and 7. So on page 55, I think it really nails this very thing. The first paragraph, that entire paragraph on the page, talks about that whole entirely ready. The next paragraph, even when we do approach it with complete willingness, another problem often arises with step 6. Some of us misunderstand this step and act as if it's up to us to remove our own shortcomings. In our attempts to be rid of dishonesty, for instance, we may try to reform and become honest. Or we see we've been selfish, so we try to be generous. Anger is one of our problems, so we try never to get angry. Or we've heard that fear is incompatible with faith, so we try not to feel any fear. All of these are good efforts, but they often seem to get us nowhere. The harder we try to rid ourselves of our defects, the more they control us. Because we have misread step 6. We are totally defeated in our attempts to work it. Thus, we learn a key truth about ourselves and our 12-step program. We are powerless over each of our defects of character, just as we were powerless over the food. It will be up to a power greater than ourselves to remove them from us. We can't do it alone. Now, this next paragraph, I think, is so crucial. If I could put this, I should laminate it and put it on a card and carry it around with me, because it really, I think, sets out very clearly that paradox. Obviously, I have a part, but what is it? Does this mean we shouldn't try to change our behavior until our higher power changes us? Should we continue being dishonest, intolerant, and all the rest? Of course not. Being entirely ready means that we firmly turn our backs on the old self-destructive behaviors and make every effort to act and live by the principles embodied in the 12 steps. But we shouldn't be discouraged if we find that we aren't changing as quickly as we would like. We can't expect to be free of all our defects overnight. What we are asked to do in step six is to become entirely ready for this miracle of release to happen to us, no matter what it may cost us, no matter what in our lives may change. Ooh. No matter what it may cost us, no matter what in our lives may change. So let me try to give a practical illustration of how I have experienced this. Let's say, for example, gossip. That's one of my really, really big things. You've heard me go on and on and on about how important other people's opinions are to me, how much I like to be liked. So if I'm in a situation where people are gossiping, right away, it's as if there's coin to be spent. And I've got a good coin. Oh, I know this juicy little tidbit about so-and-so. But I know I shouldn't say it. Well, what if I dress it up in such a way that it seems like I'm praising them or I'm sympathetic to them, but I'm actually not. I'm actually gossiping. What I'm doing is I'm talking about them behind their back in a way that I wouldn't talk about them if they were in the room. This is dishonest. But I've just walked into the trap. So afterwards, I see that I did it. I am going to accept the fact that I did it. I'm not going to fight it. I am accepting myself as God accepts me. But, bless you, I'm not going to justify it. I'm not going to now, I've seen it, so I am not going to now go through the gyrations that are necessary for me to say, well, it wasn't really bad mouthing her. I mean, everybody knows it about her. Bless her heart. You know, maybe somebody should tell her. And I made it clear how much I like her and you know, all this other stuff. That's what I love about the phrase that they use, that we turn our back on it. And so at this point, I'm no longer going to hold on to the right to act in this way. And what's happened for me is that gradually, very gradually, God has removed from me the fear in those social situations that makes me think that the only way for me to be okay in this group of people is to engage in this behavior. So, the fear, though, is what it talks about at the end. That I have to be ready for this miracle release no matter what it may cost me, no matter what in my life may change. Now, the people that I'm talking to are probably not going to cast me out of their company. But maybe they won't feel as comfortable with me anymore. Maybe they won't speak as freely with me anymore if they see that I'm no longer engaging in this kind of talk, or if as soon as we start trashing so-and-so, I change the subject, which I will sometimes try to do. I don't stand up in a huff and leave the room, because I don't think that's really good either. That's the thing in my life that might change. And so, like I said, God wants it all. So I'm going to have to trust that my social standing is not going to be dependent on the gossiping. But what if I do it again? What if I've been free of it for a while and then one day I find myself doing it again? Do I then get furious with myself, berate myself, feel disgusted and impatient with myself? Yeah, probably I do. That happens with me when I really get impatient that I'm not changed. I haven't done all this work. Look, I'm leading a retreat, right? I'm supposed to be up here talking about it. And I get this idea. Again, it's my ideas, those crazy ideas of mine about the way things are supposed to be. And what's revealing itself to me is that that's part of the process too. That the more I see myself as being a human being and accept myself exactly as I am, that's actually part of the process. So I think this chapter has such important information that it's not enough to simply be ready to have the character defect removed. We also have to accept ourselves with the character defect. I think it's like having a piece of scotch tape on your hand. You know, you ever try to shake it off, and what it does is it just sticks more closely. Because to the extent that I'm still criticizing myself and feeling that I should be beyond this, I am not acting in humility. I'm thinking I should be directing this. I should be able to get rid of this. And there's a beautiful line then on the next page. Working the sixth step is a lot like working the first three steps, which is each of our defects. We remind ourselves, I'm powerless to rid myself of this trait. I can't, but God can, and I'll let God take it. In step seven, it talks about that word humility, which I don't know about you, but that was not what I wanted to hear about when I first got into this program. When I was literally 2 weeks sober, I think, before I'd even gone to my first OA meeting, when I was, this vocabulary was completely baffling to me. I went to a meeting and I heard a man stand up and say, I just want to walk down the street and not feel better than or worse than anybody else. And I could certainly not, I could see the not feeling worse than, but don't I want to feel better than? He could have been saying, I want to walk down the street and have my arms fall off. There was nothing attractive to me about that at all. But I think I'm getting a glimmer of it, how that might feel, because I'm so addicted to that idea of being being superior, knowing more, being more capable, whatever that is. I'm the sort of walks into a room and, you know how it is, the old, if 99 people in a crowd of 100 love you and one of them doesn't, you're going to put all your attention on that one person. Or comparing myself constantly to other people. It's so wearying. That's what he was saying. That he could just walk into a room, and it wasn't even a matter of knowing that he wasn't better or worse than anybody. It was a matter of not caring. That's just not being important at all. It's just not even in the equation. Blind to that. Wow. That would be pretty nifty. So, we were talking earlier about my strong feeling that when I harm myself thinking that I'm helping others, that I am actually acting out of excessive ego. And there's a wonderful passage here now in the description of step 7 in the OA 12 and 12. As we began to recover in OA, it says at the bottom of page 59, as we began to recover in OA, we could see how compulsive eating had caused us to be obsessed with ourselves and our status, humiliated by our inability to control our intake of food and by the devastating consequences of compulsive eating. We fought for self-esteem with all our might. As our disease progressed and our compulsive eating worsened, our self-esteem fell progressively lower, and we fought ever harder to bolster it by gaining whatever mastery we could over our fellow beings. In our self-absorption, we became status seekers in one way or another. Primarily concerned with getting our own way and the recognition we craved, we tried openly or secretly to place ourselves above other people, hoping to disprove our own feelings of inadequacy. So you might say, how does that apply if I'm running myself ragged to please my coworkers? Are you expecting your coworkers to run themselves ragged? Are you not saying, then, I can do without the sleep, I can take on a double workload, I can take it, but you're human? Whoa! The laws don't apply to me. So, in that way, that's one of the most... that's one of the sneakiest way that ego shows up. When I think that I'm being of service, when I think I am placing my interests beneath those of others, what I'm actually doing is, in a way, trying to set myself above them by telling myself that the laws don't apply to me. I am not like the rest of you. Ick. That wasn't a very pretty thing to see. So, the last quote I will read is also from Step 7. And then there will be a little bit of writing. So, this is on page 61. And this talks about our attitude towards struggling with these defects. It's about the status seeking. It often happens that a shortcoming isn't removed immediately, or it returns after being gone for a while. Every one of us has experienced struggles with some of our character defects, even after praying for their removal. The existence of the struggle is not a sign that we lack humility. But what attitude do we take during those difficult times? If we are surprised, shocked, deflated, or discouraged when a defect returns, we lack humility. If we get angry at God, ourselves, or other people because we have the defect, we lack humility. Real humility about our character defects carries with it acceptance. We accept that each defect, as painful to us as it may be, is a part of who we are. With humble acceptance, we can quietly say to our higher power, I am this way, and only with your help can I change. So it is 3:15. The next question that I had for writing on, I think might, if you're really new to Overeaters Anonymous, this might be a bit of a poser, because now we're getting into the territories of the steps that come after the inventory, talking about character defects. So if you're really new to OA, I just throw this out there, see what you get. If not, doodle. That's right. I have two questions to write on. And actually, one of them is a little bit more suitable if you don't really feel like you resonate with this question. So this is the one that specifically has to do with character defects. So this is one question to write. I don't mean for everybody to write on both. Just pick one. If God removes my defects, what's my part? If God removes my defects, if it's up to God to remove my defects, in other words, then what's my part?
Is this a throwaway?
This is not a throwaway. But here's another question that I think, if you feel like answering it, especially maybe if you're newer in program, this might be a little bit more resonant. Because we're talking about a lot of actions here. We're talking about writing. We're talking about telling somebody, you know, admitting all that stuff to a person. We're talking about changing our behavior in the world. We haven't even gotten to making amends to people. And then there's all these other actions in the steps of getting a sponsor, or getting the tools, getting a sponsor, doing service, using a food plan, weighing and measuring, or not weighing and measuring if you're a restrictor, reading literature, going to meetings, going to more meetings, whatever. There's a lot of actions that we're asked to do in this program or are suggested. What actions am I afraid I won't be able to do? Is there any action that you're really afraid that you won't be able to do? And this one, actually, I would consider a throwaway if you want. If you'd like to, write those actions and throw them in the box. We will burn them tonight. But the previous question is really offered as just, you know, for your own edification. Nope. Yeah, second one. If God removes my defects, what's my part in the process? What actions am I afraid I won't be able to do? What actions am I afraid I won't be able to do? So, choose one. Write on both if you feel like it. Don't write at all. Put your head down, take a nap, whatever. But we will go until 3:30, and then we will break for our fabulous entertainment. And raffle.
Can you get started on that?
If God removes my defects, what's my part? Well, I mean, for example, I talked about the gossiping. So my part, I don't know. I mean, I think this is a very, it really depends on the defect. So I'm thinking, what is my part in the gossiping? Well, it might be literally to get up and remove myself from the room. It might be to try to find something positive to say about the person. It might be to ask myself, why do I feel I need to do this? I might be to look at, what do I think I'm getting from this? It might be to see what's the payoff? That's gossip. There's so many defects you could look at. Okay, this is the last time. Yeah. What actions am I afraid I won't be able to do? And that was just a very general one. Could be in any aspect of working the program. Today is all about surrender in action.